Kaleidoscope, a weekly talk show for women, by women, about women, between women. From the voice that is desperate to be heard to the heroine story that inspires. Every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. on My CY Radio with Mike DeZenon. Hello and welcome back to Kaleidoscope. Continuing on the journey of talking to participants of the fifth convening of the Forward Global Women, today, now we have with us a co-founder of this organization, Minnesota Senate President Sandy Pappas. Sandy, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's delightful to be here in Nicosia and Cyprus.
And it's your first visit to Cyprus?
Actually, I've been to Cyprus before. In fact, I was in Famagusta. Well, as close as I could get to Famagusta.
Okay, so yes, were you seeing it over the divide?
Right.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning. Why did you form Forward Global Women? What was the incentive, the motivation? How did it come together?
It's very personal. My daughters were raised Reform Judaism, in Reform Judaism, and one by one they all decided to move to Israel to become ultra-Orthodox, and I have 21 going on 22 grandchildren.
Whoa.
They live in northern Israel, 40 miles from the Syrian border, 20 miles from the Lebanese border, you know, in the middle of the Middle East. And so it's in the best interest of my family that there is peace in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
So it's a very personal motivation. Mm-hmm.
So how did you, because you came together with Rula Quamas and who else is the third?
Rina Bartal.
Okay. How did you all come together? How did that, because something sparks off a meeting like this.
Right. Well, it's all about relationships. My oldest daughter was in Jerusalem, and she was at some event, I don't recall what, and Rina was there at a table, and she went up, she saw it was the Israeli Women's Network, the premier feminist organization in Israel, and she went to the table, and she said, can you give me your business card? My mother would like to meet you.
Okay, well, duh.
So we met, and so this was, you know, a decade ago, and we started our relationship. So we started out doing women leadership tours. She brought a group of her board to Minnesota. I brought a group of women leaders to Israel. And on my second trip with women leaders, another member of our group, Dr. Ellen Kennedy, who's the founder and director of World Without Genocide, told me I should go to Petra, that it's a wonderful place to go. So I also belonged, and belong still, to another international organization called the World Hellenic Interparliamentary Organization, Association. And it is parliamentarians of Greek heritage, Kappas, right? Okay. Panagopoulos. I'm Greek, from the Peloponnese.
Okay.
So at one of our, we have these General Assembly meetings, and at one of our meetings in Athens, I was aware that there was a gentleman there from Jordan who was of Greek heritage. Mm-hmm. So I said to him, I would be really interested, I'm going to Petra, and it would be really interesting to meet with some women leaders in Jordan, as long as I'm there. And he said, you have to meet my sister. And that is Rula Quamas.
Oh, okay.
The founder of the Jordanian Women's Commission, founder of Women's Studies Department at the University of Jordan in Amman, a poet, a writer, an inspiration to her students, a wonderful
I've
sister.
I've never met anyone with such embracing energy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I introduced Rina and Rula, and we decided to have a convening. It was kind of a global women's leadership convening. And the University of St. Catharines sponsored us, thanks to another member of our group, Mary Jo McGuire. And we started with three women from Israel, three from Jordan, three from the U.S.
Okay.
And then it just...
That's a good start.
And it grew from there. And we went off on our own. We decided to call ourselves Forward Global Women. And we right away wanted to add Palestinian women.
Mm.
So we did that. And then I really suggested that we add North African women, because I thought, coming from some more moderate Muslim countries, they could be kind of a bridge potentially between the Jordanians and the Israelis. I think I was a little naive about that because these countries, Tunisia and Egypt, even Morocco, have their own issues with Israelis. But it wasn't quite the hostility that there is between the Jordanians and the Israelis. on the part of the Jordanians mostly. So we added Egypt, and we added Egypt and Morocco, and then we added Tunisia.
Okay. How easy is it to find the right woman? Because it's got to be difficult to get the right match.
Right. It is difficult, and sometimes our teams aren't sustainable.
Okay.
So right now, our Jordanian and our Israeli teams continue to grow stronger, and we're keeping. We're keeping probably the same people now. Okay. We have a really good team. The Israeli team was excellent last year.
That's excellent this year.
And the Jordanian team has been building. The Moroccan team was excellent last year and fell apart this year. And it's strange reasons. Morocco and Tunisia do not have Cypriot embassies. So our women couldn't get visas.
Oh, okay.
So two of our women happened to be in the United States in D.C., and so they were able to get visas in D.C., one Tunisian and one Moroccan, and join us. And, you know, Americans, we can go anywhere. So we just, except Cuba, and even now we can go there. And I've gone to Cuba.
But we just
sometimes we don't think about that. I did know that we shouldn't go to Turkey because, I had a host community there that was going to host us, because the Egyptians can't get visas to Turkey because they're kind of at odds. Mm-hmm. But thank God we didn't go to Turkey. Oh, my goodness. My Turkish friends got back to me a little bit late and said, well, okay, I think we can host you. And, of course, they're all Fethullah Gulen people.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Who is a peacenik Muslim who lives in Pennsylvania.
And who's on the blacklist of...
He has 300,000 followers, and they're all losing their jobs and being arrested. Mm-hmm. And accused with being part of the coup. And it's totally ridiculous because they're all super peaceniks and into education and democracy. And
you can't, we all know, you get rid of the academics. How are you going to build a state? You want people to be stupid.
That's right. They fired all their academics. Mm. So at any rate, though, we were very glad because we would have had to cancel the convening and not go to Turkey. So Cyprus was a better choice.
It was a good second choice.
First choice.
First, yes.
Yeah.
You weren't expecting, were you expecting it to be not peaceful? Were you expecting the spill-off from Turkey here?
Yes. We were concerned about that. I mean, things are very close here, and also after what just happened in Nice.
Yes.
And so we called the hotel, and they said, we have security cameras, it's perfectly safe here. And I tend to be an optimist, but I was following... what other people
felt. You're not alone.
Yeah, other people were nervous. Rula was very nervous coming from Jordan. And also, we decided to take the hotel location off our website and our Facebook page and also not indicate the dates that we were here.
Okay.
So I just, today is where the end of our convening tomorrow, I just now posted on Facebook.
Okay. Well, I say the one good thing about living in this country is it's safe. Mm-hmm. It's a great place for a family and for a woman. Mm-hmm. You tend to be safe. Okay, so tell us about the Moroccan team fell apart, but this year you've got Dr.
Well, I think the Moroccan team will come back. Besides the visa problem, we had a member who had her daughter getting married.
Okay, that's
so
a good excuse.
So that's always going to happen, right? And then I think we should just have larger teams. So
absolutely. So you can, people don't always...
A couple people can't come, because I'm sure we'll get... several of those Moroccans back next year.
Okay. You know, are you adding Algeria or Libya?
No. No, that's not on the horizon. I don't know what country we would add next. I personally would like to add Lebanon, but I don't think I think it's even worse for the Lebanese to associate with Israelis. And you have to, I mean... we can't just talk to each other. You know, you have to face the other. Mm. And so that's why we have to have Palestinians and Israelis and Jordanians together. And
and that's one of the conditions of joining the
meetings. Yes, yes. You have to be pro-peace. You have to be pro-women and women's empowerment. And you have to be willing to dialogue with Israelis.
Okay.
And Israelis are willing to dialogue with others. So it's not a problem from the Israeli side.
How easy was it to get Palestinians?
Palestinians actually interact quite a bit with Israelis, women, in the peace movement.
Yes, they do.
It's much more common than Jordanians. So we had a great Palestinian team the first year we added them. And then the second year, there was this anti-normalization movement,
yes, mm-hmm,
where they didn't want to pretend that everything was fine, that they could go to these national conferences. And so I had a problem with my team that year. Some of them came back then the next year. But this year we have a wonderful woman.
Huda, oh, she's amazing.
Huda. Who's from the, she's the regional director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, and is a very strong Palestinian, and she's going to help us now rebuild that team.
You know, when we first formed Hands Across the Divide in 2002, the first alliance we made, or the first connection we made, was with the Bat Shalom. Because Bat Shalom is Palestinian and Israeli woman working together. And that was the first thing we did as an organization. They were doing a demonstration. There was something happening at the time. And we sent through a letter of support to them because they were on a similar page to us with the Turkish Cypriots.
I've met with them years ago. I don't know if they're still active or not.
I also don't know if they're still active.
I haven't heard much about them. But it was Israeli women in Jerusalem and Palestinian women in East Jerusalem from, I think they called it the Jerusalem Women's Center, that did do activities and actions together.
Mm. I don't know if maybe they've been absorbed by the Women in Black.
I don't know.
And what is this upcoming activity they're organizing, the
in
March
October.
Of Hope?
Yes.
Different group. That's Women Wage Peace.
Okay.
And we have a partnership with Women Wage Peace. It's a new group that started in Israel, just a couple years old, very, very active. They have like 5,000 members, 500 who are super, super active.
Who's in charge of them, Mikael?
We had a representative from their group with us this time, Michal Barak, who talked about it. Two of our Israeli team members have been meeting with them for months. So they're doing kind of on-the-ground organizing in Israel. And we offered to provide value through our MENA connections so that our women in our different countries are going to do a peace, women in peace activity that day. And they might not be able to say it's to support the Israeli Palestinians, but they certainly can say to support the Palestinians who want peace. Meanwhile, in the U.S., we'll do extensive events. We have, we're also working with a group called J Street, which is pro-Israel, pro-peace.
Okay.
They have 34 chapters across the country, and plus our American team will also be planning events in October, probably around October 19th.
Why that specific date?
You know, Women Wage Peace picked that date. It's the day that month is like International Conflict Resolution Month.
Okay.
And I think the 20th is actually Conflict Resolution Day.
And where is it happening?
Well, it's happening, it's a very decentralized group. So we've been focusing on the March to the Dead Sea, where Israeli women will march from Jerusalem and Palestinian women will march from Jericho to meet in the Dead Sea, the womb of the planet.
Okay.
The lowest place on earth, to maybe as a representative of where the peace process is, to demand that the leaders go back to the peace table, include women in the negotiations, like we should be doing via UN Security Resolution 1325, which says women should be involved in all stages of peacemaking. And there also are going to be marches in Jerusalem. There's going to be a march to the River Jordan that with Jordanian women on one side and Israeli women on the other side, Palestinian women, I'm sorry, on the other side, where they will meet. And there's a quilt that's being, you know, women from all over the world are sending quilt pieces for a massive quilt. Mm. So
why don't you let us send me a few details and maybe we can make a symbolic Turkish
Cypriot.
Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot.
Yes,
woman.
Yes, in solidarity.
In solidarity.
Yeah, with what's going on with the Israeli and Palestinians.
Exactly, so send me a few details.
Do you have one of our packets? Because it's in there.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a whole page on it and there's a website. And
okay, good, because maybe we can do either Hands Across the Divide or the Cyprus Women's Lobby.
That would be fabulous.
Maybe we can find a way to do something symbolic on that day.
And I'll keep in touch with you about what the plans are.
Tell me, this is the fifth convening we've had here in Nicosia.
No, fifth convening we've had. First
the Forward Global Movement, not we as in. Do you have them annually?
Yes.
You usually have them in the States?
Every other year in the States. We changed after we were in the States for the first 2 years. We went to Berlin in 2014.
Another divided city.
Yes, it's very interesting. And then we were back in the U.S. last summer, and then we are here in Cyprus this summer.
And when you choose the topic, how do you come with the theme of the
Usually the planning group comes up with the theme, and Rula Kawas is a chair of the planning group. She's a professor, so she's very good at putting together conferences.
And, yes, she does, and putting together words.
Yes. And she, because of the situation with the Syrian refugees in Jordan, she made a pitch for us doing a session on the Syrian refugee situation, which we had today. Also, we had Michal from Women Wage Peace, which is one of our projects, report on that. And then we have another project we've been working on for a couple of years, our security project, and that is a Israeli-Jordanian-Moroccan project by our academics, where they've done focus groups and interviews with women defining what security means to them, when they felt secure, and when they felt their security has been breached. And they're pretty amazing stories. And they... I think each country is interviewed or had in focus group around 22 women, and they are planning on a book.
But I think it's a wonderful idea, as I said in my presentation, when we as Hands Across the Divide did that activity of what does peace mean to you?
Yes.
You suddenly realize, you think you're talking the same thing,
yes,
and you end up realizing that to me, who's a woman in an abusive marriage, peace is not being beaten up.
Right.
To you, having got a son in the to you, got a son in the army, peace means us not being at war.
Right.
So it actually it makes you realize that it's not as one-dimensional.
Right. And security is very similar.
Exactly.
Like that too.
And they're connected.
And it's not just the women immediately would say, "Oh, well, why do you want to interview me? I don't have anything to do with the military or that. I don't want to know about that. My son's past army age or something." And then as you dig a little deeper and explore the word, you get a lot more different stories. I mean, it can be land security, food security. And, of course, personal security is very important, whether they feel safe on the street or feel safe in their homes or feel safe in their families.
And you always realize when you see the way men put together peace settlements, you always realize that the peace and security they are talking about is on the macro level, borders.
Right.
Whereas women
putting down
your weapons. Whereas women tend to think, well, am I going to be safe in the street? Are my kids going to be safe? Is my family going to be okay?
And they also think about, are there going to be jobs? Are my girls going to be educated? You know, is my community going to thrive? Because they need these things in order to have a safe and secure future.
Well, but you realize that men don't think multidimensionally, and women actually think more holistically. Mm-hmm. Because they think of community. They don't just think of country.
Mm-hmm.
They think of, this is where I live. I want to be happy. I want my kids to be happy. Before we close, is there anything you want to say?
I have one, and you can answer this as broadly or as specifically as you'd like. So you said you are a feminist, an activist. You are creating dialogue between different cultures in our world and contributing to our safety and our futures. But you said your daughters chose a path of Hasidic Judaism.
Ultra-Orthodoxy.
So do they see you as just like the coolest mom in the world? I'm from New York, so I lived near a Hasidic community, and from the outside, it looked like women had very little voice. I'm not in it. But how do your daughters see your work? Or do you talk about it?
You know, sad to say, I don't think my daughters are very impressed or interested in my work. You know, whether it's my work in the Minnesota Senate or the fact that I'm Senate President or my international work. I also work with the National Women's Organization with women legislators all over the country and lobby Congress. They're just in their own little world in northern Israel, in their own little ultra-Orthodox community. And yes, they know what's going on because they do listen to the radio, and some of them are on the internet. But I think, to me, I'm mom and I'm grandma, you know.
And that's all you need to
be. And they want me to come and visit them and bring two big suitcases full of American clothes for the kids and themselves and toys.
And like you said, though, stuff, you are making their lives safer. You're organizing and
keeping them. I don't know that I've ever articulated that to them, because they think God will keep them safe, mm-hmm. not mom.
Maybe God needs a helping
hand. Yeah. I always say, you know, God helps those who help themselves. That's what my mother always told me.
Yes, he doesn't do it alone.
Right.
He doesn't do it alone. What are you...
Unfortunately, he.
We should say she.
She doesn't do it alone. What are your hopes for the future? Besides having Hillary as president.
Well, that's the first one.
Yes.
It's the biggest one.
Getting Hillary elected. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's it. It depends how far you go in the future. Now, I haven't had to answer that question for a funder yet, is where do you see Forward Global Women in 5 years or 10 years? I mean, I think that because we live in such a scary world and that things are changing so rapidly, you know, both technologically and the rise of so many terrorist groups and the latest bombings we've had all over the world, you know, horrible, horrible things. Then you have someone who just arises out of nowhere, a celebrity candidate like Donald Trump, who just flames the fuels of Islamophobia, of, you know, racism, of, you know, the white supremacists just love him.
They do.
And then you have surprising things like Brexit and Great Britain. So, you know, it's probably better not to plan too far into the future. And that's a very, in my daughter's case, it's kind of a religious concept to live in the present and not agonize over the past or worry about the future. And I always say, well, that was just supposed to be one day a week on the Sabbath, not
every
life.
Day.
You know, you got to plan for the future.
Yes.
But I do feel that, you know, I'm running for re-election this year,
so I've got
another four-year term. I hope to stay as Senate president. My colleagues have to elect me, so that's a future thing. I'll continue working with Forward Global Women. New things open up all the time. We are, don't tell anyone, it's a secret, thinking of meeting in Washington, D.C. next year, which I think our participants will love. And as we think about where can we be influential, and well, on the issue of refugees in Syria and USAID, you know, maybe we need to weigh in on that and some of those on the issues of, is our government still hanging in there with the peace movement?
I think the refugee issue is going to be so overwhelming for the next few years, because I think people are moving generally. There's a movement.
Incredible displacement.
Incredible.
Yeah, to have millions of people leaving Syria. Yeah.
So. But I was, when they were talking about displacement, that the things they were saying actually reminded me of me, because I'm a child of the diaspora. So when people used to say to me, what are you? I hate answering that question. The only thing I will say is I'm a human being. Because they'll say to me, where are you from? And I'll say, how long do you have?
Yeah, I am.
because I don't, I mean, to me, the land, I don't identify with the land. But I wasn't forced to leave.
You left of your own volition.
Yeah, right? I mean, I was born there. I didn't choose to be, but the system kept me out, so I didn't choose to leave. So I belong, but I don't belong. But it's not important, because I belong by virtue of having been born there. So it's a very complicated thing, this thing of displacement. So let's at least set it on you winning the elections, you winning your seat, and Hillary Clinton.
And Hillary Clinton winning. Go Hillary,
I think let's put those two goals, and the rest will come according to serendipity.
And your secret about Washington is safe with us.
We're not going to tell anyone. And what I actually want to thank you on there for inviting me. I feel privileged, because
we were so happy you were recommended to us, and so happy you accepted, and it was really delightful to have you with us all week.
But I do. They're a lovely group of women. I'm enriched by having been here.
I do feel like a better person, too. And it was a group of brilliant and thoughtful and communication skills off the charts. And thank you for designing it and bringing it here to Cyprus.
I thank you for coming to our neck of the woods.
And we've really enjoyed Cyprus. So I'm leaving you now to go out and really enjoy Cyprus.
And rock and roll. Okay. And thank you for being with us, Sandy. And to the listeners, thank you for listening, and have a lovely afternoon. Kaleidoscope. a weekly talk show for women, by women, about women, between women. From the voice that is desperate to be heard to the heroine story that inspires. Every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. on MyCY Radio with Magda Zenon. Hello and welcome back to Kaleidoscope. We are continuing our conversations with the fifth convening of the Global Forward Women Organization here in Nicosia. And today with us we have an esteemed guest. We have with us Dr. Fatima Sadiki, a professor, senior professor from the University of Fez, a writer and an activist. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
And with us is also Terry Cafaro. We are very honored to have you with us, very inspired by the convening that we were both present at on different days. Very humbled to be with so many exceptional women.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Forward Global for Women is really a very nice and very good, timely platform for all of us coming from very far countries and meeting people we don't meet every day.
Yes, and we meeting people in a safe environment, which means you can open up, you can listen, you can ask questions.
Exactly.
Or you can step back.
Yeah.
And you've recently brought out a book called Women's Movements in Post-Arab Spring North Africa.
Yeah.
You are the editor.
Yes.
I think we in that do not belong to that region are very interested in what has happened since the Arab Spring in terms of women's movements and the role women had before and since.
Yes, the book you mentioned deals with the region. As you know, North Africa, it includes seven countries, actually, from Sudan, Egypt, to Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and Mauritania. So many countries. So, as a Moroccan, I'm more interested and know more about the situation in Morocco. What happened after the Arab Spring, this is 2011, is a lot happened, actually, because women were very much at the forefront during the uprisings, also the revolutions. They were very present in the narrative about all this outside the region. Like, if you look at the media everywhere, the narrative is that you see women visually, you see them, and you hear them. But after the Arab Spring, what happened is that, well, there was, let's say, a door opened to some kind of democratization, and guess what? I mean, the Islamists, the jumped in, and they were given an opportunity, even by the less conservative, the secular, the modernists. All these people really wanted to give. They gave them a pragmatic, not a religious vote. We all wanted to see. That's the first time that in modern history they are taking over. What happened is that the first thing that went down was women's rights, women's visibility, the hard-won rights that really women and men fought for.
And earned.
They were we started to see them slowly going up. In Morocco, for example, before the uprising, the minimum age of marriage was 18. It was set in the Bedouin. But after the Arab Spring, somehow we hear in the parliament talk about going back to 16.
Wow.
And then we had the Moroccan movement also, getting firing at that. And we had a very... I don't know how to describe it. An event. Here is the event. A young woman of 60, Amina Filali is her name, was raped. And according to the law, the rapist can either
marry
or go to jail for 5 years. This is before. So the woman was married off with the consent of her parents
to the rapist.
The woman couldn't take it. She swallowed poison and died. She committed suicide. that thing, this one thing
event,
which happened in Assira, in the north of Morocco, had all the entire, if you want, human rights,
yeah,
women's,
oh,
everything rallied
behind
against
it.
That this one thing led to two positive development. First, talk on reducing the age of marriage stopped. Second, the law on rapists changed.
It became harsher.
Now it became harsher. He cannot marry her, and he now the rapist faces something like 30 years in prison.
Mm.
This is the new law, 475 law. So this is what's happening in Morocco. I mean, right after the uprisings, we saw a backlash. But what's good is that the dynamics continues. I mean, the like conservatives are sometimes you have the feeling that they are losing ground, and the modernists are stepping in, and sometimes it's like a step forward, two steps backward, something like that. This dynamic is, that's what I see.
It's a bit of a roller coaster. It's not static.
Do you think women's bodies are mobilized during revolutions?
Oh yes.
In general?
Oh, yes, mobilized in many, many ways. First, I mean, we have something...
I mean, mobilized and then discarded.
Yes. Oh, yes. In the culture, something which is very firm in the culture is that if a woman can do something, any man can do it.
Mm. Okay, yes.
So women were mobilized to have more men on the street. So they were encouraged, but the women themselves, when they saw that there was this encouragement, they went forward, and they took it. You know how women
yes,
take things very seriously.
And a lot of passion.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, you can go to the internet. Many women were abused, many women were killed, and especially in Egypt, and also in Tunisia and Morocco. Well, Algeria, there was not so much of that because of the civil war in the 1990s.
Yes.
So people like...
are more reluctant.
Fed up.
Yes, okay.
With anything, yes. So, yes, they were mobilized, and right after... Before, I mean, things like the Amina Filali thing, what happened is that suddenly people didn't want to see women in the public sphere.
Why? Did it upset the sensibilities?
It's because the public space is constructed in our culture as a male space of authority.
Oh, okay.
So it's like if women are there, it's like they are given, offered, between quotes, the opportunity. It's like
them power.
Yeah, not exactly that. I would say that we all feel rather apologetic in the public space at one level. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Women in the public space, it's like you have to do something that you have to do and run back home. This is not, I mean, even when no one talks to you, it's just a feeling.
It's
you feel that your space is not public.
Is it Is it like an invisible wall of patriarchy or something?
Yeah,
that's
what it is. That's what it is, because our patriarchy is based on space,
mm,
and the public space is read as a space of male authority.
Yep.
So women can be there. They can have power, but they can never have authority in the sense that if a woman expresses herself there very forcefully, okay, a lot of people will understand, etc. But authority, like
the final
religious
word,
authority,
well, the final word is with a man.
Yes, that's it.
But what I'd like you to do, let's take a step back. We know that women are the ones that mobilized Arab Spring.
Yes.
Why and how? Because as Westerners, we saw women at the back. We saw women as powerless or suppressed. So what happened that gave them the impetus or the opening door of the door?
Voice.
That and also, if you look at the history of the region, during the fight for independence, women were very much included in the fight. They were there. And if you look at the history of the region, I mean, women were queens. They were, there is a nice book by Mernissi called The Forgotten Queens of Islam.
Okay,
So women were very much,
Visible
there. But That's why when they had this opportunity, they really genuinely believed that something will change their status, that being accepted in the public space, they were willing to really show that they want to improve their lot. Women there, I mean, now that I'm talking to you, I can imagine, I can see in front of me all sorts of women, young, old, veiled, non-veiled, peasants, literate, educated. They were all out there. Some of them wanted rights. Some of them wanted land because they think that the, like in rural areas, the land, we have something, I don't know whether you have it, like the land is inherited inside a tribe by a man, not women. So
absolutely,
they want, so
yes,
they want their share of the land. Some women wanted their language, Berber, to be accepted. So some of them had like things written, which they, some of them just were shouting. Some women wanted their rights from inside Islam. They think that the Islamists have sidelined them, so they want more presence in the Islamic discourse. They want more rights, saying things like during the time of the Prophet, women had visibility. So all sorts of, to each her experience, you see them there. And the more women you see, the more women you would see the following day. It was like euphoria, especially for the youth who could really express it, because that was very visible. The younger ones, savvy when they used social media, they wanted to show that they were there.
Morocco's got a high percentage of illiteracy.
We do.
And especially with the women.
Or
is,
yes,
it, isn't it more with the women than with the men?
More with the women than men. Well, there are many ways of looking at that. In urban areas, for example, women, I mean, you see more women educated, but most of illiterate women are in rural areas. Mm. And the overall percentage is something that approaches, this is official,
yes,
something that approaches 50%. I would think more myself.
That's
because, yeah, it's a lot of women. Yes, I mean, this goes back to state building. When we got independence, I mean, the rural areas were not on top of the agenda.
Well, that happens in most countries, because even
but
the
we
country,
have yeah,
even
but we
in
have
countries like America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
when you think of America, urban, educated, forward thinking, and you forget that there's rural America.
No,
the
absolutely.
Minute you're out of the urban center, things, it's a completely different picture worldwide.
Yes,
it's not only in the Arab world where it's a lot more visible. You
because
forget
we have
about
more.
Rural America.
Yeah, rural
yeah.
America.
Or rural Europe.
That's right, because we have more rural, our geography, I mean, we have more rural, if you want, areas than I would say Tunisia, for example. In that, from that perspective, we are very much like Egypt. Egypt have a lot of illiteracy of women. You have less illiteracy in Egypt, in Tunisia, because they have less rural areas. You also have illiterate women in Algeria because of the rural, I mean,
the massive rural area.
Yeah.
Tell me what was the status of women before the Arab Spring, and what is the status now? And let's start with Morocco and take it.
In Morocco, let me contextualize this. We got independence, good. And the state wanted to be modern. It was like the thing that brought modernity. The
yes.
state brought modernity.
Yes.
And one aspect of that modernity is open the schools for urban young girls. So urban young girls went en masse, if you want, into schools, education. So we've had that.
When did Morocco get independence?
We got independence in 1956. So I'm talking like during the 60s and 70s, I would say, urban areas actually sent their daughters to school. So that mass of young girls became young women in the 80s and 90s. So you see more women going into the workforce. And at the same time, you see more women writers in Arabic, in French also, is very strong in the country. So you would see more women, they were very smart. They realized that the problem was not Islam, was not religion, but it was the way Islam was used
exactly.
by the state. So what they did is they said, okay, we fought for independence, between quotes, like the Arab Spring, but after independence, we got nothing.
Mm.
So we need to change the family law. Because why is it that all the state institutions are based on civil law except the family law, which is based on Sharia law
yes.
and other laws, but Sharia law is there. So they started in the, I would say, mid-70s, 80s, really fighting for the change of the family law.
Well, the family law is what governs everything.
It governs divorce, yes.
It governs ownership of property.
Yeah,
it everything. Covers citizenship.
Yeah.
It governs
so
the
they were,
broad
they
spectrum.
Were smart. Mm-hmm. They knew that that was the case. But then at that time, the family law was like a sacred law. Mm. By the way, it's no coincidence that the family law is the first text that was produced after independence. We got independence in 1956. The text was there in 1957-58.
Whoa, that was quick.
Yeah. As a sacred, in all the countries, as a sacred text. Because that was, I mean, the rulers wanted to pacify the patriarchs. Nothing
yes.
will happen.
We're in yes. the same state.
We
nothing has changed.
So women understood that. So they started fighting, and with men also,
yes.
with democratic men, trying to change that. But they said, I mean, the general feeling was this is a sacred text. We cannot touch it. But in 1993, because of the danger of Islamists, okay, what the Moroccan state did, well, it said, okay, the Islamists are a danger for women and for me, because they want also to take over.
Mm.
To give, we are the bearers of Islam, but our king is also the highest, I mean, he's the highest religious and authority. So the Islamists were a danger for monarchy and for women. So what happened is that the state started to strategize with women, encouraging them. You cannot imagine the number of NGOs.
That was strange bedfellows.
But,
the state of women.
You cannot imagine the number of NGOs starting from 1985 to the end of the 1990s. And even now, you cannot imagine. I mean, we had 1 million signatures to change the family law. This is 1992, the first in the region. Imagine, I mean, a country like Morocco.
What's your population?
Well, now it's, I would say, 33 million. Okay.
But 1 million is a fair percentage.
1 million signatures.
It's a fair percentage.
In the height of Islamist ideology, asking to change the Mudawana, we call it the Mudawana, the family law. And this this initiative was attacked, resisted by the Islamists and the conservatives. No, it's okay.
Was this family law, which you keep calling a sacred text, was it under Sharia law?
Most of it is, yeah,
okay.
Sharia law.
Okay.
Yeah, most of it is Sharia law. It has also the
Napoleonic,
whatever, law, the
okay.
French law. But anyway, there was this dynamic about we want to change it and so on. The socialists were, before the Islamists, were very strong in Morocco, but they didn't change.
Yes.
So they had their own agenda. So they wanted to change society, but not women's status. Okay, so the one smart thing that the king did in 1993 is to accept to look at the text. That I mean, not big changes, very small ones. Like, well, if you want to get married to the second wife, you'd better ask the first one. Very minimal,
minor,
very, yeah. very. Sometimes a lot of us consider that as ridiculous, but at the symbolic level, it was a huge thing.
The fact that he
people
actually
started
to,
realize that was not a sacred text. That was a bill that could pass in the parliament. This is 1993. Very briefly, the socialists took over,
mm-hmm.
okay? And in 1998, something very important happened. The socialists took the government in hand. So our prime minister in 1998 was a socialist. So he opened the door to women.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, and the first, we had the first minister of women's affairs. He wanted to go further with the changes.
You have a
yeah.
woman, a minister of women affairs.
At that, in 1998, it was a man.
Okay, but you have a Minister of Women Affairs.
No, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It started with the socialists, and they tried. It didn't happen. And we continued, and it happened finally after the terrorist attacks in Casablanca. That's where people understood that, extremism is not what we want. So there were these big changes in the family law. Now it's okay, but the implementation is still a problem.
Well, that's...
To answer, so that's what how we were. We were like going crescendo, up, up, up.
Okay.
Okay. The Arab Spring, what most young women said at that time is, enough with legal reforms, let's be more pragmatic. So we don't see any implementation, yes, which was good.
But they had the legal basis to work on. So what happened with the Arab Spring?
The Arab Spring is that other things became important. First, the social media and people. Now, in terms of women's rights, what the general feel was, okay, we keep on the legal rights because these women are still alive and a lot of young women also believe in legal change. But the legal change stopped being an ideology, like people using it. So what we saw after the Arab Spring is more. We want more implementation. And when you say that, you open the Pandora's box.
Absolutely.
So you have single mothers, you have marginalized women, Berber women, what have you, handicapped women. So that's why, all these things became very diversified, yes, and polyvocal. So what happened is that, women's rights did not disappear, but they became more complex.
Yes.
But they are still very important. And the other thing is the networking between these things with human rights. You see even more shades of that. So you would, for example, you wouldn't believe that a lot of young people in the social media or the conventional media ask for homosexual rights and ask for things. We didn't dare ask before the Arab Spring.
So it's opened up the Pandora's box of how broad women's rights are, or gender rights.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing is that I have the feeling that people understand now that equality is something we have to take seriously. And you see this even, you asked me before about the Minister of Women's Issues. Our current Minister of Women's Issues is an Islamist, but she's talking equality.
Okay.
She has just, like 2 weeks ago, she passed, actually, and we should commend her for that. She passed a law to criminalize domestic violence.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So,
that's a breakthrough.
It is. And she is very much resisted by her own government, by a lot of people also, but it's there. So we are going forward in a very slow manner, but it's good, exciting. It's, it's not like static and forgotten. Women's issues are there.
So the discourse, it's more open in the open discourse.
More open, yes.
What I want to ask you about, you spoke about it during the conference, is the role of the veil.
Well, the veil, that's a mysterious thing. It's a piece of cloth, but it's an ideological thing also, which was politicized especially by men.
Yes.
When it appeared, it allowed a lot of poor women to invade the public space. They can work if they are veiled. It's like, now I put this veil, it's like I am in the private space, but I am in the public space.
Okay.
So it's like a reassurance for a lot of women, and it just leave me alone. I don't have the money to make my hair, so it's good that I veil. This is how it started. The veil means a lot of things for Moroccan women. It means emancipation for some of them. It means politics as my identity. I want to say that I can have rights and be Islamist.
Yes, okay.
Yeah? It's also, it can be used in different ways, but it sees, its ideological edge of it is dying. So it's there. It has become a fashion. And
To me, a Western woman, this is the reason I asked you. Sometimes I was watching the young lady, Sakina, with the a veil, and I thought, she looks stunning.
She smokes. I don't smoke.
So to me, it wasn't. That's why I wanted to understand it as a Western as well.
No. The veil does not mean powerlessness.
Yes, that's what
not
I wanted
all.
To.
No, the veil is for many women, as I say, the passport to the public sphere of authority. And I can give you a personal story, if you want.
Yes, of
I was in at the University of Meknes, which is near Fez, where I teach, and they had this colleague of mine who put on a veil for personal reasons. So she was a lawyer. I was sitting next to her. The things that she said to 700 students about the Prophet liking women, about things like that, I could never have said. But she went away with it because of her veil. We talked about that, she and myself. So the veil gives you a lot of power in the public sphere for a lot of women. I cannot ignore that. But the beautiful thing is that women are what they are. You have a lot of veiled women in secular, and also who are also secular feminists.
Okay.
What can you do? What can you make of the veil of such a woman? She's a secular feminist. Secular means I can accept Islamists, I can accept atheists, I can accept anyone. The state should protect all religious beliefs.
Absolutely.
This is the essence of secularism. Now, going back to my words and so on, but when you translate secularism into Arabic, it becomes scary.
Why?
Because Ilmani in Arabic is understood throughout history as believing in science, not anything which is not science, just the ilm, which is science. And Ilmani, it's very easy, to just, not all, everyone understands this, to just say it's atheism. But for a lot of people, Ilmani is atheism, which it is not.
What is it?
Ilmani is secular. And if you look at our history, it will take you back to the 9th century. I read something written by a philosopher who went to the caliph. This is the 9th century. And he said to the caliph, you and I know that God does not exist, but we have to create one to survive. So it's... I don't know. This is a very complicated topic about religion. But when I say secular, I also mean in the public sphere of politics. So in politics, politicians use all beliefs. So if you are an Islamist politician, you will use the conservative type of Islam. If you are an open-minded Muslim Moroccan, you would go for secular. You would say, let everyone live the way they want. Let religion be a private thing, and let politics be what it is. You separate the two. It's very hard to do when the heads of state also when Islam is a state religion.
Yes. But could we talk a little more about the veil for a moment?
Yes, we've got about a few minutes. So
Okay. It seems to be caught in the crosshairs, though, between this public and it's being used by both sides.
That's exactly what it is. It is the intersection of private public. It's at the intersection of my rights, because a veiled woman, if she says that it's her right, how can you say it's not?
Mm.
If she wants it, how can you say? It's also generational. My generation, the veil was not an important because at my generation, I was a student, end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. At that time, religion was not highlighted across the world, not only in Morocco. Now religion is very important everywhere. So the veil is an easy instrument, you see.
But the veil is also used by men to suppress.
Oh, yeah.
So it's
for votes. For men, a veiled woman is, to suppress. But also for women, I know many women in Morocco who would prefer a veiled daughter-in-law because she's gets obedience, but they're not that obedient. For many secular women,
I'm going to base this on interviews and things I did, is that many women who really applauded one article in the family law, which says if the couple divorce, okay, so they have to divide into half whatever they have bought during their marriage. Now, the same woman, secular, educated, who say, no, it's unfair. She's not working. She cannot take half of my son's.
Whoa.
I heard this. So it's also human. It's also human, you see. So the veil is, I mean, it's used socially. It's used culturally. It's used as an identity, especially politically. That's where it becomes dangerous. Because for most Islamists, male Islamists, the veil is, one veil equals one vote.
Hmm. Oh, that's... to us Westerners, when you see the veil, you see one thing.
No, yeah. No, that's...
You don't see...
It's a very... No, the veil is much more than one thing.
But that's why I was totally fascinated when I heard you talking about the veil. I thought, you're giving me multi-perspectives.
Yeah.
It's giving it a dimension that I never knew it had. To me, it was one-dimensional. She wears a veil, she's oppressed.
No, but back in 1999, there were articles... by other people. One of the things I wrote is the many meanings of the veil. I mean, we understood this a long time ago,
but we didn't understand it in the West,
right. Because that's it's politicized. Because what you see from the West is what politicians hear.
Does the Quran say about the veil?
The Quran, there you have the imams, the religious people are of two camps, if not more. There are religious scholars, muftis, who will tell you it is an obligation, and they would give you...
Is it written in the Quran?
They interpret it their own way.
Okay.
And you have people... I know many religious scholars who bring interpret it in a way that it has nothing to do with covering your head. And then you have people... It's politicized, even in the religious field. You have different people giving it different interpretations according to their own doctrine, according to what they want, according to the type of society they have in their mind.
So you see why, though, we in the West, we are always getting this politicized view.
Yeah, but your
and
politicians
it's not this
also...
nuanced.
No. But here, the veil in the West is not the veil in our country.
Exactly.
Here in the West, the veil is identity, more than anything else.
Yes.
Because Islam lives with other religions. But in our country, like, we are all Muslim. So when we had this new family law, and I was invited to the European Parliament in Brussels, and I was all very happy to say, well, we have this and that and that, and I was not veiled. One student, a little background, she is a daughter of a migrant who left Morocco because of poverty and who is now settled in Belgium. She raised her hand and she said, I don't recognize myself in you. So we had lunch and they discussed with the young woman. It's because, I mean, here the veil is like your identity.
Yes.
And, but for us, I mean, when these young women go from Europe to Morocco, we find them very, between quotes, backward. So they are like pushing all our hard-won things aside.
Yes.
It's a very complicated thing, this veil issue. Very complicated.
But I think that's the beauty of what social media has done, has given this multi-dimension of what the veil means. Because previously, you just had the traditional media giving out the veiled woman, she's Muslim.
Yeah.
Whereas this, in the social media, you get a lot of women saying, and it was one article I'd read recently that said, the veil gives me the freedom to be judged for what I'm doing,
yeah,
and not what I look like.
I respect that.
Mm-hmm.
My younger sister chose to take on the veil. My father, I mean, who died in 2005, was dead against the veil for some reason. He said, you need to have education. But the three of us, I mean, the eldest, we don't veil. So it is, I respect that.
Yes.
I respect, I mean, the will of women. I respect that. But I also want people to know that this is a story told to me by a taxi driver. He said that he had this woman who was veiled at the back of her taxi, and he took her to a place in Fez where I live, and she said that when she opened the door and she wanted to pay him, he saw a different woman. She took off the veil. And in front of him, he see something like a casino. So she was a dancer there.
Okay.
So she used the veil to protect herself.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's the veil, it's as one colleague of mine calls it, to each her own veil. We have maybe our other veils. We don't cover our head, but we have other veils to survive in the public sphere. But the veil can be whatever you make of it. Plus the fact that it's used in other religions also. It's that's the patriarchal aspect of it. You find it in Christianity and Judaism. It's
absolutely.
So religion is. So that's why I said I don't want to go into religion. So the veil is. You are the sex, the other sex that should be veiled in all religion. This is something that is shared. Now, in Islam, it so happened because of what Islam is, Islamic countries are going through, it has been heavily publicized, heavily politicized and publicized as a token of anything you want to make of it.
And I think that's a really good note to end this interview on.
Yeah.
Today we've demystified the veil.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
And I will put online your book, of where people get your book, and I'll also put online the different meanings of the veil.
Thank you.
I'll find it online.
Yeah, you'll find it.
And I'll put it on because it's something I want to read as well.
Me too. Yeah. Mine is in Arabic, but there is an Egyptian. I can... Okay.
You will write it down for us and we'll put it down online. I want to thank you very much for this enlightening interview.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure meeting you. And
you.
Inshallah, we meet again somewhere soon.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Kaleidoscope. A weekly talk show for women, by women, about women, between women. From the voice that is desperate to be heard... the heroine story that inspires. Every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. on MyCY Radio with Mike DeZenon.